Come to order for our meeting on January 17, 2008. I want to thank you all for braving the ice to get here today. We're starting a few minutes late because of transportation. And Paul, why don't you go ahead and introduce the agenda today?
Okay. Mr. Chair, the first couple of items on the agenda are dealing with the bill draft requests that were made by the committee. As you recall, the Speaker gave each of the committees authority to request one bill draft, and the bill draft request from House Revenue is before you. That's LC 63, and we just got that. So we've been working with that. We have a rough version that we've sent to a number of sponsors and that have been involved in it, but this is the first of the response to that. So we have LC 63. The other bills on your agenda, it's entitled as Other Bill Drafts with Potential Revenue Policy Implications. What we have there are two LCs that the committee had requested be drafted through the Rules Committee. So the Rules Committee actually made the formal bill draft request, but on behalf of the Revenue Committee. And those LCs are LC 85 and 86. And so we'll talk with you about those today. You also requested that LC 84, dealing with a business energy tax credit, be drafted. That's still in the drafting process, so we don't have that for you today. We do, however, have Mike Graney here from the Department of Energy who can talk about the concepts that are currently being worked on, and we will have that for you next week. So those are the four bills we have under discussion. The four, three LCs actually in front of you, and one that we can just talk about conceptually.
Come in. Great.
Go ahead. I was just going to say, following that, one of the LCs you have, LC 86, is on a connection to the federal income tax code, your reconnect bill. We also have that same version over on the Senate side. One of the things that we're a little concerned about is kind of the timing of things. As you've been following the news, the national economy seems to be on the verge of slipping into recession or near recession conditions. And the expectation we have is the federal government may enact a stimulus package of some type. The Federal Reserve Chairman this morning in congressional testimony recommended that be done. And it's possible you may have a federal stimulus package within the next 30 days to react to and make a decision whether you want to connect to that or not. So we don't know what that form that will take. And the form it does take could be very significant for our revenue. If it's a stimulus package that uses credits, for example, or rate changes, that actually increases Oregon revenue. If it's one that reduces the base, then it actually reduces Oregon revenue. So many of you recall that from 2002 with the accelerated bonus depreciation and the effect that had. So we'll talk about that. Chris will review with you what the feds have done. And then the last part of our agenda is we have a discussion from the Housing Council. We'll talk about affordable housing lenders tax credit. You enacted an increase in that credit last session. Talk about how that's going and make some suggestions for you.
Bravo. Thank you very much.
So the first thing we have, Mr. Chair, is LC 63.
Okay, what I'd like to do before we do that is ask for a short explanation. You were very fortunate to have, on as a member of this committee, the chair of the Rules Committee, Representative Rosenbaum. And one of the things we were discussing while we were waiting for everyone to arrive was the procedures under which we are considering these drafts today. And I think it would be really beneficial for the committee if Representative Rosenbaum could describe what our plan is for how we get bills introduced into the February session.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And this committee is equally fortunate to also have the vice chair of the Rules Committee, which is actually Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee, Representative Berger. So what I'm going to describe is just a brief summary of the process. This process has been laid out in memos from the Speaker's office, and so if you have any questions about it, it's in writing too. You will recall probably that each committee on the House side was allowed to have one bill per committee, and that would be for this committee, LC 63, that's in front of you. In addition to that, the committees were able to explore other legislative concepts that went beyond just the one bill per committee, and most committees did have two was the highest number. All of those additional concepts were submitted to the House Elections, Ethics, and Rules Committee. We had a meeting on November 30th in which what we did was take those requests and approve them for drafting. What is now going to happen and is in front of you today is that the other two, which are before us as LC 85 and 86, will be approved by this committee. They will, or whatever committee they came from, those, and that simply is also approving that these bills are moving forward in the process to this extent, that those bill drafts are due on January 28th to the Chief Clerk's office by 5 p.m. At that point, all those LCs will be sitting in the Chief Clerk's office waiting for the start of the February session. So on February 4th, on opening day of that session, after the House organizes, all those bill drafts will be in a big stack in front of our Rules Committee, and we will make motions that those bills are introduced as Rules Committee bills at the request of, for instance, the Committee on Revenue, and then they will be out on that day and start to work their way through the process. So I hope that's a pretty clear explanation of how it's going to work.
Thank you. That's very helpful. And I think, just to be clear, why we've gone through that process is that we're hoping to keep the February session short, and one of the ways of accomplishing that is doing some of this part of the work in advance. So even though we're acting in anticipation of rules that haven't actually been adopted yet, this procedure would save us 3 or potentially 4 days of session time just to get bills introduced and into committees and into hearings. As far as, from my point of view, and I'd love your comment on this, Representative Rosenbaum, from my point of view, what we're doing today, although the form is slightly different, is analogous to a committee bill introduction during a regular session, except that there are these additional stages, the Rules Committee and so forth, that Representative Rosenbaum has described. So our normal rule would apply to these, and that is we don't have to agree with every detail of the bill at this stage, because we will have the opportunity as a session committee to amend bills, to do the normal things that you do after a bill is available, in order to get them exactly right. The object today is to say, yeah, these are close enough so that we're ready to ask the Rules Committee to introduce them. Is that a fair summary?
I think it is. I think, as always, when bills are introduced, people should not feel that they're expressing support for those bills necessarily by allowing them to be introduced. And I think, because February is a somewhat hybrid situation, we're trying to make sure that we have plenty of input and the bills are there in a transparent way at the same time that we are able to move them expeditiously. So,
And maybe one final comment for me on that, and that is that because we have these LC drafts and they are public, people can be prepared when the bills are finally introduced to actually come and testify and do a public hearing on the bill, because they will already know the content of it. Representative Berger.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much, Representative Rosenbaum. It was my insistence that this be put on the record because we are stepping into new ground with this session. It is unlike any session we've had before, and the processes that we establish here are somewhat precedent-setting. And so I it was just my need, I think, to make it very clear in public and as transparent as possible what our process is, so all those who are concerned with all these bills know where they can fit into this somewhat different process. So I really appreciate your indulgence in making this very clear.
Thank you. Paul, are we ready to go ahead on LC 63?
I believe so. Mr. Chair, you have LC 63 in front of you, and while we've looked at different versions of it, this is, as I said, the first time we've gotten this just back from editing in council this morning. So what we have done is, as you recall, last meeting, we asked Jeff Shane from the CPAs, who had formed a work group with the Oregon Bar, to go through the bill itself that you had approved in the form of 3201 last session and make some suggestions, raise some policy issues for you to consider. And so what Jeff has seen is a rough draft of LC 63, and he has an outline of the response as he's interpreted what we've seen. So Jeff has some material to go through with you. Mm-hmm. If there are questions of our drafter, Kay Toswell, is here, and so she's available for any questions that you have in terms of her thinking on some of the draft language. And we also have Deborah Buchanan, whom we've gone through this issue with Department of Revenue on kind of what would be some of the administrative issues for the department.
All right. I think we probably ought to hear from whichever of them want to talk then and walk us through what we're looking at here.
Barnhart, I'm Jeff Sheen.
Yes.
And I don't know if you want to hear from Legislative Council first, since my memo addresses a prior version, which is a little bit different than what you've seen.
Okay. Now, so I think we ought to go through the bill, and I'm not sure exactly what the best approach would be for that. Paul, you have a suggestion?
Mr. Chair, why don't we ask Kate to come up and go through it?
Perhaps walk us through it. Since we haven't, we only just received it this morning about 10 minutes ago, this particular draft, and we really appreciate your quick work on getting it to us. But because we've only just seen it, perhaps it would be useful to have you just kind of walk through it with us, and so members can ask questions if they have any about the draft.
Yes, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, I'm Kate Toswell from Legislative Council. I myself have actually only seen the final printed version of this within the past half an hour, but I can go, I think, starting with some of the changes that were made since the rough draft, which I believe people have seen. And some of those changes addressed, I think, some of the biggest concerns. The one thing I would point to, first of all, is that this draft now does have a table for the proposed credit. And a major change in this draft from the existing law, which was codified as ORS 118-140, is it transformed the tax relief basically from a deduction to a credit. And we now do have a table for the credit, and that is in subsection 2, the subparagraph A. And then it follows on to the next page, which is page 3.
Thank you.
Another issue which has arisen, and which I don't know if it was addressed fully in the rough draft, was the issue of what exactly was included as natural resource property. And I believe in the existing law in 118-140, there was some question as to whether natural resource property included the trees. And since the original intent of last session's draft was to provide for an estate tax deduction or credit, or at least relief for forest land property, I think the concern as to whether the trees were included was a valid one. And in the draft from December, even though we did have language about property that was connected to the natural resource property, I think the questions persisted about the treatment of the trees. And just to sort of back up on that, I think it actually did work in the previous version. That version used the definition of real property, which is found at ORS 307-010. And that definition clearly includes trees, includes timber. But then it was qualified in paragraph A by language dealing with use as farmland, and that farmland qualifier directly tied it to land only. And I believe that that is where the issues arose, and they continued to arise even after there were some fixes. So we now have a situation where we don't have that lawfully qualified at the decedent's death for designation language, which I think was causing more problems than it was solving. We do have employed at the decedent's death in farm use, and then in subparagraph C on the next page, line 5, we specifically include the value of trees and timber as value that can be used in calculating the credit. So I think that issue has been addressed. I think there were other places in the existing law where it wasn't clear that fishing property was included, and some of those were just basically just fixes. For example, on page 5 in line 26, the existing law refers to the transfer of property treated as natural resource property, and that's been deleted. So it's any property that's going to be receiving the treatment envisioned under this section. So that issue has been resolved. And then the other major issue in the existing law was the types of entities that would be eligible for this treatment. And it's been expanded to include property owned through in other entities, such as limited liability companies, trust ownership, and the like. I believe, yes, if you look on page 4 in subsection 5, there's language addressing that concern. Another issue that came up was whether property that was involuntarily converted, for example, if it's condemned or there's eminent domain, if the proceeds from that conversion could then be used to purchase property, whether that could qualify. That's been addressed.
And that's 6? Subsection?
That is 6.
Okay.
Subsection 6.
So, Mr. Chair, if I could just say a couple things in terms of kind of the policy choices. Kate mentioned the credit table. Mazin has developed that, and we're still assessing the revenue impact, but I think it'll be very close to what the revenue impact was in the original bill, which was $1 million per biennium. So we want to confirm that and work through some more state data. And so the table itself, however, is designed to come close to eliminating liability for individuals up to $7.5 million in value, and then phase out. And that's what it does. It phases out to zero for values of $15 million and above.
So it does deal with the other concern you raised earlier about the cliff.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's really designed to deal with that. The problem we had in terms of tax policy with just a $7.5 million exemption and then zero if you had $8 million in property is you're likely to get some distorting kind of behavior that people will, because the tax consequences would be so severe if you're slightly over the threshold. So that's the intent of the credit, to try to get at the policy that you had decided on in 3201, but get at it in a way that doesn't create that distortion. So we will review that, and we reserve the right to maybe make some further changes on that as we work through the numbers. The other policy issue.
Now, before we go on, let me ask a question. I think other members might have questions too, just to be sure I understand. Let's suppose that we have an estate which consists entirely of natural resource property under this rule, and it's worth $4 million, we'll make up a number here. This credit would essentially reduce the taxes owed to zero?
We think it will reduce it to an amount very close to zero.
Very close to zero.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the object of writing the table this way, wasn't it?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Trying to simulate what you're trying to do with a $7.5 million exemption.
Exemption.
Yes.
Other questions about this piece? Thank you. Go ahead. You were going to make a comment about something else.
Mr. Chair, the other comment on the revenue side that is significant in terms of the revenue impact is on page 4, section 3. You may recall that in the testimony you had on this back in December, that the issue came up, well, should there be some threshold amount in which property as a percent of the total estate has to meet in order to be eligible. And this addresses that. If you look under 3 sub A there, the total value of the property which the credit established under the section level is at least 75% of the total gross estate. So if you have an estate that's, say, $10 million in total value, you'd have to have at least $7.5 million in eligible natural resource property to be eligible. So it's a threshold requirement in order to be eligible for the credit. Okay.
I have a question.
Yes,
about
Representative
that.
Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Paul, a lot of estates don't have holdings all in one state. I mean, sometimes an estate it consists of property in other states or other things. So, would that 75% threshold apply only to the Oregon part of the estate or to all of the estate?
Representative Rosenbaum, Chair Barnhart, my understanding would be that, as far as what needs to be within the state, it would be the natural resource property, and that value would have to be at least 75% of the entire estate,
including holdings outside of Oregon.
That would be my, just off the top of my head, that would be my understanding, as it would be the entire estate. But what you would be looking at in determining whether it met the 75% threshold would be the in-state.
I think Representative Rosenbaum is suggesting a wrinkle we need to look at. Other questions? That's why we're not actually introducing today, or why we're not voting on a final bill today. We have things left to discuss.
But Chair Barnhart, I believe if there is that policy intent, I think that's actually something that could probably be fixed relatively easily, or at least clarified whether it was one way or the other.
I believe that the original intent in dealing with this issue was to provide a benefit for small natural resource operations that where the owner does not have substantial other assets from which the taxes could be paid. But Representative Rosenbaum has raised a wrinkle that we need to address, I think, in order to make certain that we're not penalizing somebody simply because they have holdings in two states. And that was something that hadn't occurred to me, and I'm glad you raised it. Other questions? And I'm not sure you were finished.
No, I'm finished, but I think it is, the way it's worded, it is the total gross estate.
I agree that that's why I'd
have to meet the 75%.
I'd certainly
threshold.
Read it that way. Yeah. Thank you. Mr. Shane? I don't know if you're ready to comment on this draft or not. If you have some comments, we would like to hear them. If not, you certainly can reserve them for later.
I do.
Okay. Good.
Should I stay?
If you like, sure.
Chair Bernhardt and members of the Revenue Committee, my name is Jeffrey Sheen. I am an attorney from Portland, Oregon, with the firm of Samuel Jolin and Cantor. We reviewed a draft which is a little bit different than what's before you today, but I think the comments that I have are germane to both. So maybe first I'll kind of focus on sort of an overview of kind of the bias of the work committee as we look at this legislation. Mm-hmm. And I think what we're looking to try and help the committee do is to develop a seamless integration of realizing kind of what existing family business operations are structured as, and try and focus that this is a seamless integration so that when this bill passes, if it does pass, that we're not having to sit down with our respective clients and say, you know, we need to materially change the way you're doing business if you want to be part of this. And so part of that kind of focus leads me to really want to comment on two major points. One is the 75% threshold. I'm not sure where that came from, but I understand that part of the interest there is to make sure that this credit is available for family-oriented business operations, and that this wouldn't be available for hobby farmers or other large holding environments. And part of my concern is with the 75% threshold, you could find yourselves with some exclusions that you didn't intend. For example, most of the business operations that would be covered by this credit don't have all of their eggs in the natural resource or the commercial fishing basket. They will typically have a residence. If they've managed to be savers throughout their lives, there's a fair chance that they've accumulated an IRA or some other type of retirement plan. And maybe they've accumulated some savings or other assets. Well, if that component of assets is more than 25% of the gross estate, then they flunk the 75% test, even though they're essentially a family-owned business. So it seems to me that some reconsideration needs to be made to consider lowering that percentage, probably to 50% is our suggestion. And I think that accomplishes several things. One is it fits into paralleling Internal Revenue Code Section 2032A, which is a 50% requirement. And it would probably, I mean, I think it still would have the effect of excluding the hobby farm type of operations, because I don't have any data on this, but it's hard for me to see a hobby farmer that's going to have 50% of their estate invested in an asset that doesn't produce a whole lot of return on investment. That just doesn't make any sense. So, mm-hmm. So I think for consistency purposes of trying to, where we can, parallel the Internal Revenue Code, I would suggest, and it's the suggestion of the work group, that be lowered. And, you know, 50% is a suggestion.
Okay, now just a quick question. From the drafting point of view, to adopt your suggestion would require a one-number change on line 10 of page 4, I think.
That's correct.
Okay, so that really isn't an issue we have to deal with today. I mean, I think it's absolutely an important issue before the bill gets voted on by the committee for passage to the floor. What are your other? I mean, unless other members think otherwise, but I think that's a policy issue we can deal with at that time. And I think I really appreciate your bringing it up now. What were the other suggestions?
Okay, the other issues are really wanting to focus. I mean, the bill says that if you own property in an entity like a corporation or a partnership or a limited liability company, mm-hmm. That the credit should continue should apply. Okay. And we agree with that concept, but I think, again, for purposes of making sure that this bill works on the ground, if you will, mm-hmm. Bear in mind that not all, but a large number of family natural resource businesses do operate their businesses in entities, either limited liability companies, corporations, or the like. Mm-hmm. And if those entities use real estate, it's fairly common for that real estate to be in another entity or owned individually and separate from the business operation. So, and then usually there's some kind of a cash lease arrangement between the two entities. Now, it seems to me, on the one hand, that we've said you've got a material participation requirement that's being imposed on entities. Well, an entity that holds real estate that's just receiving rent doesn't have a whole lot of material participation in terms of their activity. So rather than create a trap for the unwary, I think, you know, this bill should try and be either a little more flexible on the material participation or consider excluding the material participation requirement for any entity that owns land. Just because of the way that people do business.
Let me see if I understand the question, unless someone else has a question. I think what you're saying is that in some cases, Farmer Jones operates a farm, but he operates it in partnership with his sons under a limited liability partnership rule, making up the club.
Right.
But he owns the land personally, or he and Mrs. Jones own the land. So it's in a tenancy by the entirety, perhaps.
Well, it could be a tenancy by the entirety. It could also be in a separate LLC.
Okay, so he has a separate LLC that actually owns the land. And then the business entity that owns the tractor, the inventory, and the other things that go into operating a farm, rents the land from the land LLC.
Correct.
In the actual operation, this is a business entity, even though there are two different LLCs or LLPs that technically own the different parts of the entity. Is that the situation you're positing?
Yes.
Okay. So now I have a question of our drafter. Can we draft this thing in such a way that it takes into account the fact that it's common for farms at least, to be divided up into these different kinds of entities, and we treat them, we pierce the veil, as it were, and treat the whole thing as if it were one lump for the purpose of this statute? Can we do that?
Chair Barnard, I believe that we can. The one thing, I would have to look at this further, but the one thing I would wonder about is once you start to remove the material participation requirement, whether you are diluting the intent of the original.
Yeah, I'm not likely to favor that approach. I'll just say that up front. I am interested in not penalizing people because they have peculiar forms of ownership. We're looking at actual practice and intent and the control of families rather than the specific details of how they actually own the property. I think that, unless other members of the committee think otherwise, I think that's where we were headed with this, wasn't it? And so drafting something that deals with that issue without diluting other aspects of the bill is something we'd like to try to, I personally at least would like to try to do. And if other members of the committee have other thoughts, I'd love to have you pipe up. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to apologize because I was not at the last hearing at which this was discussed, but it would be helpful to me to just hear a brief description of what the problem is that this bill is intended to solve. And because obviously, you know, everything is complicated about the tax code, and there always are opportunities in the 2009 session to deal with complicated things, but mm-hmm. My understanding is that we're trying to solve simpler problems and ones that will not have an enormous price tag attached to them would be
right.
Good too.
Thank you. And let me attempt that because I think I'm the one who made the attempt last time, and let me try it again and see if I can get there. This was not my bill. It was brought by our Representative Clem, Representative Boone, and the original bill that we're trying to modify now was passed by the 2007 session. As I understood it that then, and I think as I understand it now, is that the object of allowing a reduction in inheritance taxes for certain folk was based on the belief that there are people out there whose business is a natural resource business. They tend to have their assets entirely involved in the business, and trying to pay an inheritance tax is a significant impediment to the business because the business assets are needed to operate the business. That's the essence of it. And the so all these other aspects of the thing that we're working on is to try to limit it so that we're only dealing with those kinds of businesses. We're not dealing with the Les Schwabs of the world who may in fact own a $7.5 million farm out there, but whose total assets are so large that we shouldn't be giving him any kind of a tax break on the basis that he has cash flow problems, because he doesn't. At least not on that basis, at least. And so all of these other aspects of this came about trying to make certain that we limited this tax break to those entities, those family-related entities, who are operating these small natural resources businesses and whose assets were essentially involved in the business in such a way that paying the inheritance tax would be an undue burden on them as compared to other people of similar or larger estates. Is anybody want to add to that, or Representative Witt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There are also concerns as this would impact owners of some natural resource businesses, trying to correct a situation where an inheritance tax in many instances encourages over exploitation of the resource in an attempt to be able to pay off the taxes. Those perverse outcomes.
Cutting
being
the trees.
Yes.
And you're right, thank you. And we were trying to also prevent that issue from happening. We've heard stories of people having a tree farm who had to cut all the trees 30 years early in order to pay the tax. Well, that doesn't serve Oregon well to do that. And that's what you're referring to, I think.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. That was an additional point that I think the sponsors of the bill, and I'm speaking for them, and that's dangerous, but I think that's what they had in mind, among other things. And so all these other limitations, and of course the other side of this is we don't want to spend more money than we have to, because when we spend money here, Ways and Means Committee quite appropriately yells at us because we're spending money that should otherwise go to schools and health care and public safety. And so we try to write this bill in such a way that we spend only the amount we need to actually accomplish this purpose. Yeah, Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, if I could speak to Mr. Sheen's initial comment that he wants to make this as seamless as possible with the way things are on the ground. I agree with that in theory, but I'm a little concerned of the unintended consequences of trying to get. It's sort of like we're trying to fit this into all the boxes that are out there for this subset of estates. And none of the boxes are of the same size or the same configuration, and they have been configured based on, in some cases, nothing to do with tax code and everything to do with trying to cut out Uncle Henry 20 years ago or get, cousin so-and-so to have this little plot 50 years ago. I mean, I have a family like that, and I know family farms grow up that way, and I'm a little concerned that we may not get there in terms of this complicated piece of code, if we try and, I guess maybe I'm thinking this might be full employment for attorneys like you, that these farms, in order to qualify, they're going to have to come to good tax attorneys and say, how do I make my estate fit the tax code, not, whatever internal issues drive these sort of, and am I wrong on that, or am I...
Well, I think we share that concern. I think, we might end up a little bit differently. I mean, the reason I'm here is, in a sense, to make this work so we don't have to create a lot of fees going through to reanalyze.
And I appreciate that, but...
Go through, and I think that, since Oregon passed the limited liability company statute a number of years ago, there are an awful lot of entities that are in that form, and I think the concept is if we are tied, and I noticed the new bill moves in the direction of tying somewhat to 2032A of the Internal Revenue Code, some of these issues get solved with that tie, because the 2032 does look at an integrated approach, as opposed, and that might do away with the necessity of having to exempt, you know, land-based LLCs, for example, from the material participation, because in effect 2032-8 does that. So,
go ahead.
So I think in part, I mean, is if you're willing to do the work now, and essentially I think what this group will do is sort of set, here's the concept that we want to establish in terms of what it covers. And as I see it, you'll probably do that with the legislation. And then the Oregon Department of Revenue is going to be invited to step in and provide the regulations to get you there. And so I think at this part, you know, we would just like to see it laid out, so that because the world operates now more so than in the past in an entity environment, we don't want to see people get caught in the crossfire of not complying with this statute because their property wasn't held individually, which was part of the reason we came forward after the passage of 3201. So that's what we're trying to accomplish.
Thank you. I wonder if we can ask you to work with legislative counsel and see if there are any changes that are needed in this draft. Based on the concerns that you have, now I'm no expert, but I'm not sure that there are changes that are needed. I mean, I note, for example, on the top of page 5, the second line, that the transferee must materially participate in the business. It doesn't say in the business entity, but in the business. If you read that in the normal sense of the term, the business, of course, might include a number of different entities. I have no idea whether, in fact, that's the way it would be interpreted by the Department of Revenue. But, I mean, that seems to be one of the issues. But rather than trying to hash it out this morning, I think that the committee can note that this is a concern, that before we send a bill off to the floor for a vote in February, we'd better have it figured out. Is that good enough this morning?
Yes. Beat it to death, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you. Is there anything else we should be hearing on? Were there other issues that you wanted to raise?
In the interest of time, I guess there's sort of one other sort of issue that is related to this, and again, I don't know that the committee can solve this, but I think if the charge is to work with legislative counsel, we're more than happy to do that. And that is also to recognize that what will happen when the decedent passes away is that business hopefully will survive and pass to the second or third generation. And one of the things that we want to also sort of, if the intent is to protect and preserve that, typically in the second or third generation, you're going to have one or two family members who operate that business, and you're going to have probably several others that don't. And it seems like the intent of this group may very well be that credit the fact that we have related family heirs who are not material participants shouldn't interfere, you know, or reduce the credit if, in fact, that business is continuing to operate. And, you know, I haven't sat down to review what the impact of the new draft will do to that, but I think, you know, that, again, is the issue of seamlessness.
Chair Barnard, just if I could address one point. We were just looking at page 5, line 2, and that language in paragraph B, and it does read, a transferee must materially participate, and I think that was an intentional choice. So it need not be all transferees who are participating, but I think the idea was that at least one of them was, and I think that gets to at least part of this issue, and I think that was an intentional word choice. That it would not read the transferee or all transferees.
Oh, I see. The term A means at least one of them.
But not all, necessarily.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's moving in the right direction.
Thank you. Yes, please.
I think specifically with regard to the draft and Chairman Bernhardt, I'm a little uncomfortable on with the word employed on page 1 on line 9 of I don't think land is typically employed. I just, I mean, employed has a lot of implications beyond the scope of just tax law. And Kate, you may be, if you're comfortable with, for example, used, I think that would be a more appropriate choice for the word in that section.
Thank you. And I think, again, that's an example of something that you and council should work out. One of the reasons, members, why we're spending so much time on the drafting of this issue, Bill, is that the work group quite accurately pointed out to us that at the time you're dealing with a decedent's estate, the chances of making repairs in the plan are gone. And they have a direct professional interest in making certain that we get this thing in a form that they can then use to advise their clients. It's really not so much the policy issues that you're concerned about, I think,
right,
as it is being able to correctly advise your clients about what the court is actually going to do after they're no longer around to participate in making decisions.
Precisely.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just one more question about the effective date of the legislation. It appears that this draft will affect anybody who dies, who's already dead, in fact, in some cases, after January 1st of 2007. Is
yes.
that correct?
Yes.
This draft, Representative Rosenbaum. So it's really a retroactive credit. The bill takes effect 30 days after the end of the February session. And I guess my question really, I don't know whether it's to Kate or to you, Mr. Shane, would be, really does not give the opportunity for those estates to do anything different than they've already done for people who are already deceased by changing the law and then applying it retroactively. So how will that work?
Chair Bernhardt and Representative Rosenbaum, this bill already is in effect. I mean, it passed the last session and was effective January 1st. And I think what the work group came to this committee with is, who does it apply to? Was kind of the big issue
right.
that we faced. And so in some respects, a lot of this bill is a technical correction to clarify who specifically this law would apply to.
And actually, you asked to have it apply all the way back to January 1st, 2007, didn't you? In order to essentially replace the bill we passed last time.
I don't know that we specifically asked that it go retroactive. I don't think we have any objections to it, but I think we were also sympathetic that if the committee had concerns that you couldn't go back that far for whatever reason, that we would live with whatever you want to work with. But since it was created January 1st of 2007, it sort of makes sense to go back there unless there's a very strong reason why you shouldn't.
I will note that one of the sections of the bill says that you can choose to use this provision or not. And the original bill didn't say that. Whether you wanted to or not, you were stuck with it.
Correct.
So this bill fixes that and actually increases flexibility for estates.
That's correct, it does. And this is a good step in our opinion. So, and that's one of the things that it does correct. And you can do a partial election
yes.
as well.
Does that help, Representative Rosenbaum?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure, because I'm just trying to think if the goal here is to have a simple process where people can plan their estates, a shifting terrain that then you have choices about how to apply it or not apply it. Seems like it would make it, although there may be tax benefits, I'm not sure it makes it really easier for people not to need lawyers and a lot of money to be spent trying to plan their estate. I mean, that if the goal of this is supposed to be to help family operations who can't afford to have, you know, huge bills of law firms representing them or accountants, then we ought to have something that's fairly simple to apply. I mean, as I said before, I know nothing is simple in this committee, but.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Other, thank you, Chairman.
Other comments? Does the department have comments today? No, you don't have to.
Mr. Chairman, I would probably be wise not to, but if I could just, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue, just make a couple of quick comments on the material participation. Mr. Chairman, I think you're accurate that the language that is in the draft does talk about the business, not the property. So I think we can deal with that. It would very much help to have it clear that not all of the transferees, not every transferee that benefits by the credit necessarily has to participate, because we hadn't had that reading. And what I really wanted to talk about, though, was the retroactive piece, and just make the committee aware that we actually have had returns filed that took advantage of the law that was passed in 2007. And at least one of those returns that I know of would be disqualified by the provisions in this bill because it did not reach the 75% of the estate. So in that case, that estate would actually owe additional tax. There is a provision that we may waive penalty and interest if they do owe additional tax, but I did just want to bring that to your attention.
Would a provision that said that this goes into effect but that you can use the 07 statute instead if you wanted to for those periods, that would deal with that issue, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chairman, it would deal with that issue.
Right. Thank you for bringing that to our attention. All right. What committee? We have the option now, if we want to recommend the introduction to the February session of LC 63. And part of the motion would be that one of the committee members moves that LC 63 be recommended for introduction to the February 2008 special session. What's your pleasure?
Ready?
Yes, Representative Berger.
You want to hand me the language you want? Mr. Chair, I move that LC 63 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session.
Discussion. We've already had it, I guess. Is this something we need a roll call on? I don't think it is it? Are there any objections to the motion? I guess that is the roll call. I don't see any objections, so the motion carries. We will recommend LC 63 be introduced at the February special session. Paul?
We have part of our agenda on other potential bill introductions with revenue implications, and there are two of them. And the first one was LC 85, which I'll talk about very briefly with you. We have been working with the chair and with the Treasury and with the DAS as well, and kind of how the Oregon Growth Account is operated, the revenues that have come in, and so forth. And the Treasury has supplied a schematic for you on the Oregon Growth Account, how it operates, where the revenue comes from, and actually provided this to the Senate as well, Senate Revenue Committee. The LC 85 is essentially designed to increase the reporting requirements that are currently in ORS 348.701 or 703. And The reason for that is concern over the size of the growth of the stability fund in the Oregon Growth Account, which currently receives 10% of the revenue flowing in the Education Stability Fund. When this was established in 2002, when the Education Stability Fund went to voters, this is all statutory and not part of the Constitution, but the statutory component didn't make any changes really from the old endowment fund setup that was established back in 1995. So really the design here is to increase those reporting requirements and raise some of the issues associated with the fact that the Oregon Growth Account is now a sub-account of a stability fund, which you may need for liquidity purpose at some time in the not too distant future. So that's the intent here is to direct the Treasury to address some issues that have come up and also to make some recommendations. And you'll notice there that in Section 2, sub 2, recommendations on the appropriate size of the account, for example. If you notice on your schematic here that the total commitments of the fund now are up to over $84 million. So the fund has grown significantly from what it was a few years ago, and of course that's due to the fact that lottery revenue has grown so significantly. Recommendation on appropriate use of declared earnings of the account, what happens when the investments begin to return some revenue, and then management of the account in a manner that's consistent with the overall purposes of the Education Stability Fund, which of course is to provide you with revenue during cyclical downturns when you need it to maintain basic services. So that's the bill has essentially envisions a one-time report that would come before the appropriate committees prior to February 1, 2009.
And you'll notice this doesn't change anything about the way the account operates. It simply asks for information. Any discussion? Now, is this another one of those issues that we are asked to make recommendations about introduction?
Yes, Mr. Chair. This would be one, too, that you could you would have the same motion you had earlier. The original bill draft request for this came through the Rules Committee.
Right.
But what you would be doing at this time is the same thing you did with LC 63, recommending that the bill be introduced.
Okay.
And then, of course, that would, as Representative Rosenbaum described, that will go through the Rules Committee as the formal introduction. But you're recommending that this LC be formally introduced at basically the first day of the session.
Right. Thank you. What's your pleasure?
If you're ready, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Reed.
Mr. Chair, I move that LC 85 be recommended for introduction at the February supplemental session.
Thank you, Representative Reed. Discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? I don't see any objections, so the motion carries.
Thank you very much.
Paul?
The next LC we have for discussion, and we do have a little bit of more extended discussion on this as well, but it's LC 86. And LC, well, maybe what I should do is at this point, Mr. Chair, before we go to LC 86, if I could. And we have a request in that also went through the Rules Committee, the draft request on LC 84, which proposes some modifications to the business energy tax credit. And this is based on some experience that Department of Energy has had. As you recall, this was one of your major policy decisions made in the 07 session was to modify that business energy tax credit, expand its use, include renewable energy, increase the percentage on the credit. And we have discussions with Department of Energy and the Governor's Office and with Chair Barnhart and suggested changes in light of the experience that the department has had with use of the credit. And we do have Mike Graney here who can talk conceptually about some of the ideas behind the LC 84, which is currently being drafted.
Okay.
Hi. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Mike Graney, Director of the Department of Energy. The concept that we're dealing with is follow-up of the legislation that you passed last session. In particular, you increased the amount of the credit for renewable energy from 35% to 50%, and the project size limit from $10 million to $20 million per project. You also made an important change that allows facilities which manufacture renewable energy components, like solar silicon manufacturing facilities, to qualify for the credit. And these, this is, as we've been implementing the bill, we've run into some unanticipated issues. These are large facilities. They're desirable facilities. They employ hundreds of people and high-paid jobs. It's really a variation of the high-tech industry. And we've had three companies, SolarWorld, Solex, and Peak Sun, make decisions to build facilities in Oregon already because of the tax credit, and there's other companies looking as well. The issues that are raised, first of all, when we deal with an energy project in a business, if it's lighting or a heating system or a cogeneration facility or something like that, it's very straightforward and it's clear what's one project. With these manufacturing facilities, typically they're built in phases. You'll have the building itself and a production line, and each of these production lines can run $10 to $20 million and over one or more years. And these are warehouse type facilities the size of a football field in some cases, and they will build these production lines in phases depending on both the volume of equipment or volume of sales and also the types of different solar applications they're building for. And as we've been developing rules, and we finished our rules for the rest of the bill that you passed, we set this issue aside and have been doing additional rulemaking that's pending right now to try to answer some questions as to, one is, when can these facilities qualify for more than one tax credit? And because of their size, because of the phase in which they're building. Also, to what extent, you know, do we have the authority to do more than one tax credit at any given site? And we've been operating under sort of an R&D provision that we have in the law, but it doesn't give us the kind of clarity that developers need for this large investment. So the concept that we've discussed with Representative Barnhart and Department of Revenue, as well as the Governor's Office, would give us some criteria as to when we can determine that there's these types of projects would qualify for more than one tax credit. And also allow us to approve out a number of years so that a business would have certainty, and we suggested up to 5 years in advance, so they would know that if they make the investments that are described in their applications, that would qualify for X percent or X dollar amount of tax credit in years 2, 3, 4, and 5, 5 years from now. There's also another aspect that is different from lighting fixtures and heating systems, and that if the company changes or goes out of business, that building, as long as it's there and being used by any kind of company, is going to have those energy savings features, so the state's investment will continue to pay off. Potentially, because the tax credits are transferable, you could have a large solar manufacturing facility that's received a credit, built the building, built perhaps a production line, but then goes out of business. And the state's investment is lost because that building then may become just a warehouse again. We certainly hope that doesn't happen, but it certainly has happened in the high-tech industry generally. So we're looking at some criteria that the department would use, such as the likelihood that this company would be in business for a number of years, has the financial wherewithal, likely benefits in terms of jobs, like benefits in terms of the economy, whether it would have benefits in terms of promoting the diversity of renewable resources, some criteria like that that would allow us to determine if more than one tax credit would be justified in that case. So that's the idea of the legislation. It would have a shorter sunset than the current business tax credit for these provisions so that you could come back and evaluate whether, in fact, it's working. We'd also have a cap on the annual total projects we could certify under this provision in addition to the individual project cap, whereas for normal business investments in energy efficiency, renewable energy that they're using themselves, there's no program cap. We don't turn people away when there's a certain volume reached because of the policy to encourage renewable energy and energy efficiency. And these provisions would apply if you pass this bill as it's being drafted right now. It's 1108. So decisions that we approved in last year for these companies, for example, that acted on based on the legislation that you passed wouldn't be disadvantaged. And with the rulemaking that's pending right now, developers know that there's some issues that have to be resolved. So I think the timing for an effective date of 1108 would make a lot of sense. The bill, we have a draft that our Attorney General has prepared that we should be able to get to Legislative Council through your committee in the next day or so. So that hopefully that would be out next week if you meet then.
Thank you. Questions?
Thoughts on this issue? Would you address just briefly the urgency of doing it now rather than waiting till 09?
Mr. Chairman, I think that we have both the businesses that have located here already need some guidance as to the expansion plans because they are all three of them are planning on building in phases over a period of time. And the Governor's Office and the Economic Development Department are in active discussions with other companies in the renewable energy manufacturing that could make a decision to locate plants here. And the idea of clustering in a given resource is one that's been a high priority of the Oregon business plan each year. That they really believe that's a way to help strengthen the economy. And it would help also in terms, I think, of seeing more use of renewable energy if we have these facilities right here in Oregon.
Thank you. Other questions, comments from Mr. Graney?
I appreciate very much the chance to bring this issue to the committee on really pretty short notice. We didn't anticipate this issue when the legislation was passed last year.
Right. We were assuming we were passing a retail sales bill. We didn't think we were talking about manufacturing. Recently, there's been a land rush, basically, mm-hmm. in that area, isn't mm-hmm. there?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Thank you. Members, if we get a draft on this bill, we'll have to hold a short meeting next week in order to deal with it. I consider this an urgent enough matter so that it's worth having another short meeting to do it. Members, if we have to, can join by phone so we can keep it brief. But now would be a great time to ask questions that you might have. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, just to follow up on the LC 84, what we'll do is when we get the draft through a Legislative Council, we can email that to all the members so that you'll have that in front of you. So even if you have to participate by phone, you'll have that in front of you.
Yeah.
The last LC we have for your consideration is LC 86. And on LC 86, we actually intend to introduce this identical bill in Senate Revenue Committee this afternoon. So there'll be two versions of this connection. It's the standard connection to federal tax law bill that you tend to see every session. Our feeling is that one of the advantages of the February session is that you can speed up your connection process. So you do have the rolling reconnect, so you do tend to connect to most all base changes, but there's always a series of things in federal law that potentially you'll need to connect to, or, of course, you always have the decision in the constitutional authority constitutional requirement that you make the policy decision as to whether you want to connect or not. So the rolling reconnect is not in lieu of that. It's just a process by which you that decision is made automatically, and then you when you meet, you decide whether you want to concur with that. So this gives you a little bit earlier look at what federal activity has been. And as I mentioned at the beginning of the meeting, we do anticipate the possibility of some federal actions in response to the slowing national economy. And there may be some further decisions for you to make in February that we don't know about at this point. We have, so the LC 86 is connecting to federal tax code through 123107. And right now, you're connected through 123106 under current law.
Do we have any sense of what the revenue impact might be on something like this?
Mr. Chair, the next item on your agenda is a kind of review of what the federal actions have been taken, and Chris is ready to go through that with the committee.
Okay. Maybe we should do that.
Should we introduce this first?
Do you want to do that? Okay. Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move. I knew you'd want this. I move that LC 86 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 special session.
Thank you, Representative Berger. It moves LC 86 be recommended for introduction at the February 2008 session. Discussion. Are there any objections? Seeing none, the motion is passed, and we will recommend LC 86 for introduction to the February 2008 session. Paul?
And I'll turn over to Chris. Chris has been tracking federal actions. You may have been following that, particularly in terms of the alternative minimum tax was one of the major discussion points. But there's also a number of things that the federal government didn't do, and so Chris can talk about the actions and inactions that have been taken.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Chris Allenack, Legislative Revenue Office. The handout that you have before you is the federal litmus titled Federal Legislation Update, and it's broken down into two pieces, the five bills that were passed in 07, the actions, and then the potential issues for 2008, the so-called inactions for 07. And these five bills that are listed here are what are referenced in the bill that you just the ledge concept that you just introduced. So I was just going to touch briefly on all of these and some of the highlights or some of the major pieces of legislation that were in them. By and large, there weren't any significant revenue impact piece of legislations that were in there. So right now, I'm still going through the details and the minutiae of some of these bills, but I'm not expecting a significant revenue impact to LC 86 to answer that question. The first one there, the Small Business and Work Opportunity Act, was passed at the end of May and primarily contained an increase in the federal minimum wage and then some other tax provisions there. The largest one in terms of revenue impact was a modification to the Section 179 expensing, and this is as you recall, this is the provision of federal law that allows small business or all businesses to expense rather than depreciate certain investments in machinery and equipment all in 1 year. Prior to this, the current law was there was a limit of $100,000 on that expensing, and that was set to sunset in 2009. And what this bill did was extend that through 2010 and index that to inflation. The Section 179 is in recent years has been a subject of change almost every year in terms of increasing that expensing amount and extending it further out. It also contains a limit on the value of the property that can be expensed. And the bill increased that to $500,000, and then that's phased out over a period of income there. So that increases that expensing, which is a deduction, and that is a piece that Oregon is tied to automatically through the rolling reconnect, because that's a business deduction. But on that piece, I did want to point out that the kind of implicit revenue impact in that was about a $15 million loss of revenue in 2009-11, and then it would be a revenue gain in the subsequent biennia about $8 million in 11-13, and then $6 or $7 million in the next plan because it's a shifting. But that won't appear on any revenue impact statement. That's implicit. That was a decision that the Assembly made when choosing to go with the rolling reconnect. That's, as Paul was referencing earlier, that's a tie to the tax base, if you will. And in terms of dollars, that was the most significant piece that passed in 07. Other pieces in that act were changes to the work opportunity tax credit, which is a federal credit. It extended that to certain veterans and disadvantaged youth, and also extended the sunset on that. It had been scheduled to sunset at the end of 07 and now goes through August of 2011. And there were some provisions to S corporations as well, things like excluding capital gains from passive income in terms of determining how the S corporation is taxed so that there's a revenue loss to there, and that will be a minimal impact to Oregon. The second one, the Energy Independence and Security Act, received a lot of debate throughout the year and at various points had several tax provisions in them, and kind of the theme there was different methods of accelerated depreciation for certain equipment and so forth, and certain investments in renewable energy and those kinds of things. In the end, most of those provisions were removed, and while the bill did a lot of non-tax things, this is the bill that where the feds increased the CAFE standards from 25 miles per gallon to 35 miles per gallon by 2020. Kind of the one piece that would affect Oregon is a depreciation piece of expensing for certain oil companies, and that would have just a minor impact on Oregon, again, through the tax base and the apportionment factor of the oil companies, and they're just their small piece of tax that they pay to Oregon. The third one, the Mortgage Forgiveness and Debt Relief Act, was the federal response to the subprime mortgage crisis. And the biggest revenue impact there was the debt forgiveness that was instituted for tax years 2007 through 2009. Under current law, if a taxpayer owes a certain amount of money and say they owe $200,000 and $20,000 of that debt is forgiven, then that $20,000 is considered taxable income and the taxpayer is required to report that and pay tax on it. What this bill does is if that debt is pertained to mortgages in certain cases, then it is excluded from taxable income. So it is not taxed. And then that's how the revenue impact flows through to Oregon, again, through the base, not through the specific tie date. And that's for tax years 07 through 09. A couple of other provisions in there were also the deduction for mortgage insurance premiums. I'm not sure how it made it into this particular bill, but there was an exclusion of benefits for certain volunteer firefighters and EMTs. So that, again, flows through to Oregon, that it's in the mortgage bill.
Congress. Mm-hmm. But we never know for sure why Congress does anything in any particular piece of legislation.
Right. They don't know that there's rhyme or reason. The fourth one there is the Tax Increase Prevention Act, and this is another bill that throughout the year had many different provisions in it and a lot of one-year extenders and so forth, and I'll get to those in some of the inaction piece. In the end, this was just that all this did was the one-year temporary fix on the AMT. And as you recall, I'll talk a little bit more about the AMT, but as you recall, the AMT, there's a large exemption or a standard deduction, if you will, for that piece of the federal income tax. And in recent years, that has been increased by the feds. When it was introduced, when the AMT was created back in around 1970, this exemption amount was not indexed to inflation. And so that's part of the AMT problem that you're familiar with. It was sent to go back. The prior law under 2007, those exemption amounts would have been about $45,000 for joint filers and $34,000 for single filers. And then what this bill did was increase them to $66,000 and $44,000 thereby. There's a chunk of taxpayers, a relatively large chunk of taxpayers, who are now no longer subject to the AMT, but just for 2007. The long-term problem still exists. And the last one there, the Tax Technical Corrections Act, the feds didn't even score this, at least not that I can find, so I'm pretty sure there's no revenue impact to this, but I'm still working through that. I believe it's various technical corrections to recent federal law. And it's and I'm still working through the details.
Is it long?
It's long. Yes.
Good luck.
Yes. Thank you. And so as of right now, those are the five bills that LC 86 addresses and that we would know about in terms of connecting. But as Paul mentioned, there is the stimulus bill that we're not really sure what will make it in. The other piece here, the inaction that was taken by Congress in 2008, I broke down into three different groups. We had provisions that sunset on 12/31/07, so those are already gone and arguably could be treated differently at the federal level because they are gone in terms of reinstituting them. And three of the primary ones there are the sales tax deduction, which would just, it doesn't affect Oregon, but it does stir up a lot of conversation about the cost of that. Two others that do affect Oregon are the teacher classroom expenses and the qualified tuition expenses. These are so-called above-the-line deductions. They're a federal adjustment that everybody can take, regardless of whether or not they itemize or take the standard deduction. And so if those were to pass, those would, again, flow through automatically. And legislation wouldn't need to be passed to connect to those, but that would be a potential point of consideration in terms of choosing a policy to disconnect to avoid the revenue impact. The next piece
Excuse me, if I understand it, these would actually increase our revenue, wouldn't they?
No, Mr. Chair, the teacher classroom expenses and qualified tuitions or deductions, they decrease the base.
They do, and so when they go away, that increases our revenue, doesn't it?
Correct.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But as a public policy, this is a credit for teachers that are paying for things that might otherwise be considered things that the government should be paying for. And so since we know that a lot of classroom teachers in Oregon are buying lots and lots of stuff and have for years out of their own pockets, not sure that we would gleefully be taking in more money because more teachers are out of pocket.
Yeah, my comment was not intended to be a policy statement, simply a question of fact, and I completely agree with you. When I first went on the school board in Eugene, I was astounded to discover that almost every teacher we had actually took money out of their own pockets to buy classroom supplies and other things.
Yeah. Thank you. Yes, that's the $250 deduction. The next piece there, provisions scheduled to sunset in the near future, these are largely from the Tax Cuts 2001 through 2003, the so-called EGTRA and JEGTRA, not to throw out acronyms, but I've forgotten actually what they stand for now. And largely these sunset around 2010. And just to go through those quickly, the federal tax brackets and tax rates are set to change at 2010. Right now we have a six bracket structure where the rates are 10, 15, 25, 28, 33, and 35. And under current law in 2011, we'll drop back to a five-bracket structure. The 10% bracket goes away, and we go to a 15, 28, 31, 36, and 39.6 bracket. The second one, and again, that's just the federal tax, so the impact on there is just the indirect because those go away in 2011. The federal liability for these folks will increase, and that will decrease increase the subtraction in. The second item is the child tax credit. Right now it's at $1,000 per qualifying child, and in 2011 that will drop to $500. And that could be a piece of the stimulus package that gets discussed in terms. One of the policies that the Fed's been talking about, or the recommendations that the Fed chair provided, was that the stimulus would need to get money directly into the hands of taxpayers to stimulate, to prop up demand, and one mechanism would be a child credit that would get at the family aspect. Nobody has mentioned that specifically, but they had done some of that back in 2001. The joint filer provisions, these are also referred to as the marriage penalty provisions. In these cases, under current law, the standard deduction for joint filers is twice that of single filers. In 2011, that it goes back to a prior schedule where That is not the case where the joint standard deduction is less than twice the single, and thereby the nickname the marriage penalty. And the same is true of the 15% tax bracket. Under current law, the 15% tax bracket is twice what the single filer is. In 2011, it'll go back to a different schedule, so it is no longer twice as wide. The capital gains and qualified dividends tax rates, right now, they actually, one of them changed for in beginning in 08, and so for 08 through 10, those rates are 0% for taxpayers who have income in the 10 or 15% bracket, and they're 15% for those in the higher brackets. In 2011, the preferential tax treatment for qualified dividends goes away, and it becomes taxed as ordinary income. And then capital gains goes back to a 10% and 20% rate structure. And the Section 179 expensing, as I mentioned earlier, in 2011, it will drop down to a limit of $25,000 in a given year, with a $200,000 limit on the investment property. And then, again, the last item here just listed for information purposes is the federal estate tax, which goes away in 2010, but then comes back in 2011 with its prior 2001 law. But as you know, we are tied to 1997 law, I believe, so that doesn't directly affect Oregon, but it is out there for discussion. The other potential issues right now were some bills that that Congress didn't quite get to act on at the end of 2007, and we expect that the discussion will continue into 2008, although that they seem to be eclipsed by this stimulus package, which we're really not sure what form that will take at this point. I guess we've talked about the stimulus. The military tax breaks, some of the pieces there that have been talked about would be treating combat pay as earned income for purposes of earned income credit. We'd be allowing veterans to receive distributions from flexible spending accounts. Tax compliance, the discussion there is centered on the tax gap and tax shelters. One piece of the tax gap discussion is potentially collecting credit card payment information from small businesses or from businesses as a way as to triangulate what their real income is. If they're spending via their credit card activity, if they're spending X, is that in line with what they're reporting for their income? Tax shelter is there and has been focusing on the transparency of offshore accounts and working with the tax haven countries to make all of those transactions transparent. The farm-related tax incentives could also be farm and energy, and generally the theme there pertains to depreciation of machinery and equipment, biofuels, alternative fuel, energy credits, and those kinds of things. Now, to the extent that any of those make it into the stimulus bill, it's anybody's guess. The stimulus bill, as you probably read in the papers, they're talking about in the neighborhood of $100 billion. It's my understanding that at least the White House has been received information from the governor's office to leave the tax base alone, to not touch the tax base, thereby automatically flowing through. One possibility for the federal stimulus would be to reduce the tax base, but then that has the effect of automatically reducing the tax base for many states. So that has been discussed at the federal level to please not do that. And then that leaves, or that gears a stimulus in the order of some kind of credit or reduced rate or something like that. There does seem to be agreement that they could move with him quickly, as Paul mentioned earlier. So there may very well be something in February or by February. The last piece that I wanted to touch on was the alternative minimum tax, because it does seem it is a perennial issue, and Congress in recent years has been sticking with these one-year fixes where they just increase the exclusion amount for 1 year. And I just wanted to step back a second to describe the alternative minimum tax and how it interacts with the federal, the regular system, if you will. And basically, they are two parts of the same system, and often how I view it is that taxpayers calculate their tax under each system, and then they pay the larger of the two. In a practical matter, most taxpayers don't do that. You need to get up to a certain income level. But when taxpayers do fill out their form, they're directed to a worksheet that is about 15 to 20 lines long, and they fill that out. And if they get to the end of that worksheet, and depending on circumstances, they're directed to a different form, Form 6251, and then they fill out that form. And some taxpayers can actually go through all of those steps and still pay no alternative minimum tax, which is one of the reasons it's so aggravating to taxpayers and accountants. Or it's an accountant.
So better than paying more tax. So you either pay more tax or you pay your accountant
more
tax.
Full employment.
But how they work, the regular system, if you will, has the six brackets that range from 10% to 35%. Under current law. And the AMT has two brackets. And the theme there under the AMT is a broader tax base and lower tax rates. So the tax rates there are just 26 and 28%. And the 26% bracket is for taxable income from $0 to $175,000 and 28% for $175,000 and above. And just looking at the tax rates, you can get a sense for why the taxpayers who are most affected by this are taxpayers in roughly an income range of $100,000 to $500,000, using very fuzzy numbers. Those aren't in law. I'm just kind of provide a sense there. And then taxpayers above $500,000 really aren't affected by the AMT on whole. And that's because the regular tax rates are higher than 28%. Mm-hmm. So if somebody has enough income so that they have a good chunk of their income is taxed at 35%, then the AMT is going to result in less, depending on some other circumstances. That's why you kind of have this bubble in terms of the income distribution as to who's affected by the AMT. One of the odd things about the AMT in terms of broadening the base is exactly how that's done. When it was initiated back in 1969, it was on the basis of information that 155 taxpayers in 1967 whose income was above $200,000 paid no tax. And so that was felt to be unfair that you had this small group didn't pay any tax. And so the idea of the AMT was to get at some of these deductions that are taken by high-income folks with a lot of tax planning and ensure that they paid some level of taxation. Where we stand now is that the two most significant ways that the base is broadened is by disallowing the state and local income tax or sales tax deduction and personal exemptions. So there, those two pieces you have for the state and local, the state income tax, I'll just stick with income tax because of Oregon. Taxpayers who pay a lot of state income tax are going to be affected more by the AMT. And so you have a system like Oregon where, as you know, we have an income tax but no sales tax, and so all of the weight is on the income tax. And so Oregon, this deduction for Oregonians is larger than the national average because all of, you know, a good chunk of our local, state, and local taxes is through this system, which is deductible, as compared to a state that, say, has all three of the so-called legs of the stool. Then that tax burden is split between their income tax and the sales tax, and they can only deduct one of those. So that automatically their deduction is going to be less on the whole than Oregonians. So the states that get affected most are states with high taxes, or the income tax. And so places like California, New Jersey, New York, Connecticut, and then Oregon is in the mix there as one of the most affected. And the other piece, the personal exemptions, are disallowed. So there you have a situation where a family of five or six is going to lose $15,000 to $20,000. Their tax base is widened by $15,000 to $20,000. By the sheer size of their family versus a single filer who just loses the $3,000 exemption. So the mechanism by which the base is broadened, state income tax deduction and the personal exemption, I think would be hard to qualify those as significant tax planning techniques used by taxpayers to get out of paying tax. And again, that's the source of the aggravation. But that's also the source of why so many taxpayers can get lumped into this. Because when calculating the taxable income, a lot of the deductions are disallowed, and it's simplified. Rather than having a, and now I'm blanking on the federal standard deduction amounts, $10,000 or $12,000 deduction, it's a $40,000 deduction. And so federal law was set to go at that standard deduction, if you will, it's an AMT exemption, was set to go from about $63,000 in 2006 to $45,000 in 2007. So you have a lot of taxpayers in that group that now have to go to the AMT. Their so-called middle-income families are paying a lot in state income taxes. Families are going to be in the mix there. And their standard deduction of the AMT would be reduced, so now they get thrown into the AMT. And the numbers can be pretty significant. At the federal level, in 2006, there were about 3.5 million taxpayers under the AMT. And in 2007, had this not gone into effect, it would have been about 23 million taxpayers. A lot of people would be moved into it.
Well, and if I may, this particular mechanism you're talking about would affect everybody who actually pays an AMT, wouldn't it? The ones who are in it would pay more, and some who were not in it would get into it and have to pay more.
That's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, that number there is just the people who are right under it, but now they get pushed into it.
Right.
Another aspect to the AMT that I wanted to touch on and how it interacts with the regular system is that it really is a minimum. You calculate your tax under the regular system and the AMT, and then you pay the higher. So if your AMT is up here and your regular system is here, it's that marginal difference that gets reported as the AMT on the tax return. And so you can change the AMT amount or you can change the federal amount, and that pushes people into or out of the AMT. And so what we'll see under current law in 2010 to 2011, the federal regular tax system, with the tax rates increasing and the child credit falling, there'll be a large federal increase in taxes. So you'll have a lot of taxpayers who, going from 2010 to 2011, in 2010 they may be in the AMT, but when it goes to 2011, because of the rates increase, their regular system, the regular tax goes up, and now they're pushed out of the AMT. So, under current law, we'll still see this big jump into the AMT in 2008. It'll be there through 2009 and 2010. Come 2011, we'll see a lot of taxpayers fall out of the AMT, but then the growth rate will continue on as it is now. The growth rate is mainly due to these exemption amounts not being indexed for inflation.
And amounts to bracket creep, huh?
Yes. And all of these issues are extensively discussed at the federal level, but in the end, they keep coming up with just these one-year extensions because it does get to be an expensive fix, if you will.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess this is more of a policy, not a policy question, a process question. I'm not sure that it's addressed to Chris, but there's really a perfect storm, I think, going on right now of a combination of very uncertain economic times, political gridlock going on, I think, and efforts, I believe, in Congress to benefit middle-class taxpayers that are being stopped by a combination of politics and just the economy. So I guess my question is really, what are we doing with this bill, given that it seems like things changing at a federal level in these uncertain times are even more, it's even harder to track than it normally is what's going to happen in Congress. And so I'm asking the chair and Paul what we would be contemplating doing in this bill.
Okay. Representative Rosenbaum, this bill really is a, you cannot prospectively connect to actions that Congress may or may not take. But
that's
you
a
do,
good idea.
But you can't, you couldn't if you wanted to. But the rolling reconnect will connect you to those changes in the base unless you act not to take action. This bill doesn't change that. That's your current law, and that would stay in place. Now, you may recall back in 2003 through this committee,
the decision was made to disconnect for a period of time. So that becomes an option for you to consider at some point if you want to take that step. This bill doesn't do that. It keeps the rolling reconnect was reestablished in 2005, and that keeps it in place. The only thing that this bill does, as currently drafted, is connects you to these essentially minor changes that were enacted up until December 31 of 07. So it does not connect you to any stimulus package changes other than through the rolling reconnect through the current law. So what we would envision happening here is to, this bill amounts to really almost a housekeeping type bill because it's connecting you to the minor changes. But if there are changes that occur while you're in session in February, then you would have a vehicle to perhaps make a decision whether you want to connect to those changes or not connect to some changes in the base. So it'll serve that purpose for you. Now the timing of this, of course, is anybody's guess. So it may be that you'll have to come back at some future time and make that decision. But this bill itself is, in its present form, really only would just provide some additional certainty for taxpayers that whatever technical changes were enacted last year will be incorporated in the Oregon base.
Yeah. Accountant bills we were talking about, Representative Rosenbaum.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chair, so because I don't really know what's going to happen in February in Washington, D.C., I don't think anybody really does. What if we were, so we wouldn't be connected to changes that happened after we left this building? I think what you were saying was we are connected to those changes unless we act to disconnect, and then it seems like there's really no opportunity to do that unless there were future special sessions of the legislature, which I haven't heard anybody talking about.
Representative Rosenbaum, we are, through the rolling reconnect, and this bill doesn't change that policy, we do automatically connect to those changes in the base. Now, there are certain actions that Congress may take that are not changes in the base that you may want to connect to. If it's something that's not a change in the base that you want to connect to, you'll have to take action to do that. And you will, if you have enough time in February, you could do it at that point, or you'd have to wait till 09 in order to make that change. What will happen when you come in 09, under any circumstances, you will have another reconnect bill that would connect you through 12/31/08 to consider. But I think the real issue for you that will come up, as it did, if we can just use history as our guide, in 2002, Congress passed a major bonus depreciation bill that had a significant impact on all of the income tax states' revenue. A number of states decided to disconnect from that depreciation. The Oregon legislature, and many of you participated in that decision, made the very difficult decision at the time because of the revenue situation to stay connected to that. So that's where you really, this is where, as Chris is pointing out, the details of that stimulus package is so important to your state policy decisions. And that's why the National Governors Associations are sending that message to Congress to be aware that what you do really affects the states. If they end up with an additional credit, then you have no actions to take because it's not a base issue, and you get the indirect benefits of some additional revenue. If they do something like that reduces the base, then that will just flow right through to the revenue forecast and make it worse, unless you decide to disconnect.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let me just add briefly to that. I think what Paul's doing here is presenting us with this bill to deal with the contingency that Congress acts while we're still in session or even this month, and we decide we want to do something, we'll have a vehicle to do that. Mm-hmm. Let me make just one additional comment, and that is that I think it's pretty clear to us that there is a possibility that the national economic changes will have an impact on Oregon. I'm not saying it will have an impact, but it's possible that it might. If it does, then it is also possible that we may be looking at revenue changes that we may want to address later in the year. Obviously, we're not to that stage yet. It may never happen. We hope it doesn't. But in that event, then, of course, any changes that Congress made in the base might trigger a desire on our part to do something to prevent erosion of revenue that might occur later on in the year. I mean, this is all very speculative at this point. Probably won't happen, but it's just something that one of the things that this committee needs to pay attention to, and that the and that Paul gets the a few sleepless nights over now and then.
One thing I might add, Mr. Chair, about kind of the process issue is that if the scenario you describe, that you want to make a decision that does end up with a positive impact on revenue, depending on the opinion from council, if it's significant, it's likely to require a House introduction. You have to originate in the House.
Correct. That's another wrinkle. Another wrinkle on it. So we don't know what's happening. We do know that that the national situation makes us want to be cautious
and alert.
Very cautious.
That could be the theme of our committee. We could start getting that printed on our letter.
Cautious and alert.
Cautious and alert.
All right. Anything else on this topic? Thank you. That was a very useful presentation, and good luck reading the fine print on those bills.
Thank you.
Paul?
I'll just say one other thing in closing for the committee, to remind you that Chris has what we call the tax calculator, which is our income tax micro-simulation model. So we will know, and we can look at various proposals once they take shape, and Chris can run the numbers for you and give you a sense of what their impact would be on our revenue, whether it's could be positive, if it's a credit, or a negative. So you would at least have some sense of what those dollars might look like as those discussions take place.
Yeah. Now, the question is, would the committee like to take a 7-minute break before our 11:15 item? I see the people are here for it. We can just go right ahead. What's your pleasure? I don't see anybody asking for a break. Paul, go ahead.
Well, then we will take a break.
We'll stand at we'll stand at recess until 11:15. Okay.
Hi.
And revenue will come back to order. Paul, we have one more item on our agenda.
Yes, Mr. Chair. In fact, most of your discussion this morning has been about issues that came through House Bill 3201, as you recall, which was your major revenue bill from last session, had the component on the natural resources estate tax changes, had the component on the business energy tax credit that Mike Graney talked to you about. Another part of that bill was involved the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, in which the cap on that tax credit was increased from $11 to $13 million, and the there was an expansion in what was eligible projects for which the credit could be applied. So we have asked the Oregon State Housing Council to come before you, talk about how that has use of that credit has been applied, and I believe they also have some suggestions in terms of some future policy decisions.
Okay, let's hear from the council.
Hi, I'm Larry Mettinger. I'm a builder from Ashland, and I'm the head of the State Housing Council. With me is Victor Merced, who's our director of the agency. We're here before you today to talk about the tax credits, as staff mentioned, and also to tell you about just sort of give you an interim report in the middle of the biennium about how we've been using that. Victor is going to give you some details. I'm going to ask later on for several folks from the council to come forward and give you some details from their particular specialties. One of the things I just want to say is that I've heard some concerns, you know, discussed this morning. I'm sure you worry about this kind of thing all the time, about cutting into the
the state tax base, and certainly tax credits is one of those vehicles where you have to consider it fairly carefully. When we're looking at those kinds of things over at in the housing division, I'm an old guy, so I still call it the housing division. We look at, you know, what are the multipliers for us using state monies of various kinds, layering it in with RD monies and bond monies and other things. What are the multipliers? What are the actual tax effects to the state? And generally speaking, I think, or hopefully we can show you today that what we're asking for, which is a $4 million increase in the OAHTC capability, will definitely not be in the negative for the state. So without further ado, Victor, would you like to...
Sure. Thank you, Chair Mettinger. Mr. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, thank you for inviting us today. Again, for the record, Victor Merced, Director of Oregon Housing and Community Services. For the past 30 years, many housing providers of rental units entered into contracts with the federal government to provide housing for needy households. And the federal government paid the owners of these projects a subsidy so that no one in those units paid more than 30% of their income for housing. And a large number of those contracts that were entered into 30 years ago are expiring. Matter of fact, a large number are expiring within the next 6 years. And so our department is working with existing owners and new owners to renew these federal contracts, rehabilitate the units where necessary, and then set up state contracts to keep these units affordable for the next 30 years. And this biennium, as Chair Mettinger has stated, we've approved funding and underwriting to preserve over 1,600 affordable housing units. Unfortunately, we've run out of OHTC, and so we've reached our limit. We estimate that for the year 2008, there are about another 1,848 affordable units throughout the state that will expire in the year 2008. Again, most of these units come with a federal subsidy. There are about 4,500 low-income Oregonians that are also affected, living in these units in 40 cities throughout the state. And so our goal is to keep these units affordable because obviously it's cheaper to preserve these units than build new ones and then try to get a subsidy to keep those units affordable. And so as a department, we just want to say that we're supportive of the proposal by the Housing Council, and we believe that what they're bringing before you today is very important to Oregonians. We appreciate the strong leadership of the Housing Council and their recognition of the state's current preservation needs. So we have testimony today from other Housing Council members as well as our technical support staff that can go through the details of how the tax credits work and how we're preserving these projects. So, Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn it back to Chair Mettinger, if that's okay, so you can introduce the next two members.
Thank you.
Thank you, Victor. I'd like to ask two folks from the council, Judge Scott Cooper from Crook County and John Epstein from Wells Fargo. He's the vice president and manager of the real estate group in Wells Fargo.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Reed, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify to you today. My name is Scott Cooper. I am the county judge in Crook County. I have been the county judge for 7 years. I was counting the number of you that I've appeared in front of on various issues. I'm trying to figure out what those issues were, whether they were successful or not. My recollection is they generally were, so let's hope today is as well. The first thing I would like to emphasize is the role of the council in being here today. We were apprised at our last council meeting the fact that we had used all of the affordable tax credits, and the staff was taking the position that it was they hadn't been turned loose by the governor's office to come and raise this issue and put their hand out and ask for additional help. because that's part of the overall strategy, is to let the legislature lead in this session. It is your session after all. And the council's response was, we were appointed by the governor and we were confirmed by the Senate, and our job is to come and raise the alarm on these issues and at least make sure the legislators know what the challenges are that they're facing and to present them with alternatives so that they can make smart decisions about how to administer the resources of the state. So we will be glad as council members to take the role if you as staff people can't be able to be the leaders on this. And that thus we who are volunteers who care about this issue are here today to make our best case. This is a repeat appearance on this particular issue. We were before you in the 07 session. At that time, the request was, I believe, $5 million in increase on the cap. The committee's response was, well, let's give you two and see how you do. We did very well with the two. Thank you very much. And we're back to tell you again that the actual number that we're needing right now is somewhere in the vicinity of the 4 to 5, minus the two you already gave us. The issue at hand is that in 40 communities across the state, they're spread all around the state. This is not an urban-rural issue. This is not a Portland issue. This is a statewide issue. We're talking about 1,848 units of housing which are scheduled to go back to market in 2008. That's about 4,500 people who would be living in those particular units, most of which receive a federal subsidy, and the value of that federal subsidy over 20 years is $259 million. At least that's our best estimate of it. Should we lose these, given that for these folks who fall into the 30% of median income category, depending on the place where you live, that's a household income for a family of four between $11,000 and $27,000 a year. You can imagine about how far that would stretch. If they were to lose their housing, you can imagine what the impact would be on employment, on their stability in the community, and probably what their demand might become on state services, particularly on the health care side. If you can't be employed, you're not likely to get benefits, and you're not likely to have a quality health care program. And where do you go when you don't have a health care program? We all know the answer to that. So we are looking at a significant injury to Oregonians if we don't find some way to resolve this situation. And as Larry mentioned, we're looking probably at this wave continuing for the next 5 years as we hit the end of the contract expiration period, and then it kind of calms down again because we've got these wrapped up in 20, 30, and 40-year contracts, and we'll see you again in 20, 30, or 40 years. It reminds me in some ways of the bridge problem where we put it off and we put it off and we put it off. We had to deal with it all at once. I'd say we're probably essentially in the housing market back to that same sort of scenario. I would conclude my portion today by simply raising to your attention the efforts that we are currently making in this state, and this is at every level of government, to help a few of our coastal communities which have been devastated by the recent weather events. If I had all 1,848 units in one place in this state and they'd been devastated by a natural disaster, can you imagine how much weight we would be throwing as a state at trying to keep those people in their homes or put those people back into their homes? This is not different. They just happen to be scattered around the state instead of put into one place. This is a disaster that's looming. There is an opportunity to avert it, and I would ask for your assistance in helping make sure that this proposal, which does not cost you real dollars in the 07-09 terms, will be able to help people long-term to help themselves. And with that, I turn it over to my colleague, Mr. Epstein.
Thank you. excuse me. Chair Barnhart and committee members, I'm John Epstein. I'm a member of the Oregon Housing Council, and I'm also the division manager for Wells Fargo's Community Lending Division for the western part of the U.S., which specializes in affordable housing lending. As a banker, I'm here today to provide you sort of the economics and the numbers that illustrate the importance of our request for a $4 million increase in Oregon affordable tax credits. As you may know, the Oregon affordable housing tax credits represents a 4% tax credit, and what that means, and it runs for 20 years. And what that means to bankers is we lower our interest rate 4% on our loans. The bank takes a 4% write-off, but what that really leverages into, it leverages into about $100 million in private debt that can be used to help preserve these properties. So the key of this credit is bringing, again, private commercial banks in to help finance these properties. That's the old private-public partnership that we're all looking for. Just recent history, just to reiterate a little bit what Scott and Larry have said and Victor, last session you increased the credit from $11 to $13 million. That increase, plus some other credits we had from previous sessions, led to us preserving 1,610 units that have already been preserved or are currently being preserved right now. And of those 1,600 units, almost 1,500 of them are for very low-income people at 30% of AMI. So 92% of those units are for people at this very low income level. What does this really mean? You heard Larry mention it's for 40 different properties. These properties range in size from 8 to 235 units. The 235 unit property is sort of an anomaly in Portland. The average size of these properties are really 40 unit projects, so they are small in nature. And again, they hit from very, very small communities to some larger communities in our state. What we're really doing here is we're trying to prevent these units from going to market rate, because what will happen is developers, if we don't have a plan in place for someone to buy these from them and keep them affordable, go to market rate units and the rents will go up and these people will be displaced. Of the of the 1,600 units I mentioned, that about 1,500 of them have Section 8 vouchers on them. So the positive part of this is federal government coming in to support housing in the state of Oregon. We have looked at what that Section 8 voucher means to the state of Oregon. These vouchers would be renewed for 20-year periods if these properties can use the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credits and be preserved, and that equates to about $250 million over 20 years. So the state will have federal money coming in over the next 20 years that represents $250 million. If we don't preserve these units and they go to market, these HUD contracts go away, and there's no guarantee they'll be allocated to new construction projects we might do. In fact, currently the way HUD is, it's very difficult to get Section 8 for new projects, but they are keeping them with old remaining projects that are being preserved. So I think that $250 million is a compelling number. Also, what is the new cost? If you look at cost of units, it varies, but affordable housing units, because of all the subsidies that go in, are a little more expensive to build new. And if you look at what's been costing in the state, it's about $190,000 a unit. If you look at 1,600 units, if 1,600 units were lost at $190,000 a unit, that's $305 million that we would have to find in replacement dollars to build new construction. The trade-off is, if we can preserve these, we've estimated it's only about $65,000 a unit to preserve units. So the difference is almost $200 million in savings if we preserve these versus letting them go to market and then having to build new affordable units. So if you add that up, I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers here, I'm a banker, but if you take $250 million in the HUD dollars we'll preserve, and you take the $200 million we're going to save between rehab costs and new costs, you're looking from $400 to $500 million that we can preserve here by really doing a fairly small credit at the state level. Our current request, again, right now, as we stated earlier, we have already or will be preserving 1,600 units. We've identified another 1,800 units at risk currently, and that's what this credit will help preserve. And of those 1,800 units, 1,562 of those units have Section 8 vouchers on them. So if we look at these specific units we're trying to save this year, it will represent about $270 million in preserved federal money coming in as HUD subsidies, and it will also save about $300 million in new construction costs. So before, I told you we're currently saving about $400 million that we've already allocated. We have the potential to save about another $500 to $550 million with this current request in money that will stay in this state. Also, I think another thing that is important to note out is the way we do these programs, at a minimum, these projects will stay affordable for at least 30 years. Some of them will have even covenants on them to keep them affordable for 40 years. So this isn't a fix for just 5 years, and then we have to deal with this again. It's preserving properties at affordable rent levels in these communities for 30-plus years. I think the question always is, what else is on the track coming at us? Just so you know, there was a lump of these coming all at once. We're right now at the bubble. But for 2009 through 2013, we've identified about 2,800 other units that will be at risk. So we are going a little bit on a downward slope after we achieve this. But just so you know, that's what's coming at us in the future. In conclusion, I just want to thank you for allowing us to make a presentation to you. I think the numbers are compelling. We're, addressing a lot of Oregonians here. And I actually think the amount of the $4 million increase in credits, when you look at the magnitude of these other numbers, is a very reasonable expenditure at a state level. And this, again, creates a long-term fix for us. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is this the appropriate panel to ask a specific question about numbers?
Sure. Well, we sure have people here to refer to if it isn't.
Support right behind us.
Give us a try.
I've heard at least two different numbers for what it is you're asking for.
Okay.
Could you be very specific about that?
Okay, I'll take that. We're asking for a $4 million increase in the $13 million cap that we have now. And what that will do is it will allow us to address most of, about 92% of those 1,848 units that are at risk. Now, we're going to assume that we're going to lose a few anyway. And so, and I can tell you that, this is a flexible situation. One of the things I really enjoy about working with the agency is that they act a lot like, in their actual day-to-day contact with the real world, they act like a lot like the private sector. They're very aggressive. They go out, they work with these folks on an individual basis, and they try and find new folks to take on the projects, whether it's an NGO or whether it's another private entity. And they are, and so we're going to have a success rate. Now, if we, say, have an 85% rate of success, we're not going to spend all of what we're asking. So we're not saying we're going to go spend $4 million. We're saying that we would like to extend the cap so we have the ability to handle everything pretty much that we're likely to get.
Thank you. Other questions for this panel?
I do.
Yes.
Thank you,
please.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I had a question, and it's clear, and I thank you for being here, that there's a huge problem here and an unmet need. I had a specific question about how that $4 million or even the $2 million that we already allocated gets prioritized. Could you explain how, when these projects are coming up for expiration, how do people get in line and who would be served specifically by a $4 million allocation?
That's a department question.
Yeah, I think that would be... Rick, would you like to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Rick Krager. I'm the Deputy Director for Oregon Housing Community Services, Representative Rosenbaum. In terms of your question with priority, the way the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, way we prioritize in the department, is we have what is called a consolidated funding cycle in which we allocate monies where projects are able to come in. So there are opportunities to use that credit for a variety of needs. One of our top priorities in the department is preservation. Obviously, as you've heard today, there's great savings and being able to do this type of acquisition and rehab. So as the projects come in, we take them in from an application standpoint, if either through the consolidated funding cycle. There's another process that they can use as well with our bond financing programs. So we take them in, we underwrite them. So it's sort of a first come, first serve. If it is a consolidated funding cycle, it's a competitive type process that they go through. If it's projects that are coming through our bond financing program, it's if the project can meet the underwriting standards that we have, we're able to fund it. So what has happened in the 1,600 units that you've talked about, those are projects that have come into the department, have submitted an application. It has federally subsidized housing projects. We look at it. If it meets our underwriting criteria, then it's in our pipeline.
And a follow-up, Mr. Chair. So, Rick, would it then be possible to find out who's waiting in line and where additional dollars would be directed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, I would be happy to provide that to you. In fact, we have actually some spreadsheets here that can show you exactly where all those projects are. We just didn't want to overwhelm you with a bunch of numbers, but certainly I will have staff pass that out, and we can walk you through every project that we see of those 1,848 units.
You have to be a paperophile to be on this committee. And so we like paper.
More than happy to provide you with paper, so Representative Rosenbaum, we'll provide that to you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, to be responsive to your, further responsive to your question, I'd like to reemphasize Mr. Krager's point that
there are a multitude of different programs that we use in trying to address any individual problem. Affordable housing is one of the most complex finance areas that has to be dealt with in the state. So we may have as many as 15 different programs involved in any one project, with a little bit drab of money coming from here and a little bit from there, some state, some federal, some private, as we try and put these together. So by no means is the affordable housing tax credit the sole answer to the problem. We'd be happy to come before you on some other day and explain all the complexities of affordable housing finance if you were ever so inclined.
Other questions for this panel? I think you had some other people you wanted to present too.
Can I add one thing?
Yes.
I think I just sort of maybe introduce the other people coming. What we're talking to you about here is the Housing Council is the long-term fix for dealing these things for 20-plus years, 30-plus years. and just because I have an interest in this other group coming up also, they're going to talk to you sort of about how we do this on a very short-term fix, some other money related to the short-term fix. And I think the two really complement each other. Ours is the long-term fix, and theirs is how to deal with immediate crisis so we can get these properties quickly and then move them on to the long-term fix. So I just wanted to make that introduction before they show up.
DHS.
Oh, first DHS, after DHS, excuse me. I'm sorry, after DHS.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, yes.
Morning.
Good morning.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Deputy Director of Operations for the Department of Human Services. And we're here today to speak in support of the Oregon Housing Council request related to the OAHTC program. As many of you know, the lack of safe and affordable housing is one of the main issues or major barriers that our clients, the people we work with, face in their path either towards self-sufficiency or to live as independently as possible. Lack of affordable housing has major impacts on our clients in the mental health system, kids who are aging out of the foster care system, as well as people we are working with who are trying to move towards self-sufficiency. Any reduction of the current availability of affordable housing units does have a pretty severe impact on our clients, and it could mean that our clients either are going to require more services or will have to access the services we provide for a longer period of time. So we really see that as this request as kind of the either cost savings or cost avoidance measure in the human services area. The issue of homelessness is one that the governor's office has been very active in. We've worked extensively with Oregon Housing and Community Services on the Ending Homeless Advisory Council, and we also have been working with the Department of Corrections on the Reentry Council in reintegrating people who are coming out of the prisons into back into society. And the common theme that really kind of runs through all these issues is the need for sufficient units of affordable and safe housing for these people to be successful. And with that, I'd like to end my presentation and be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Commissioner Berger?
Mr. Chair, if you'll indulge me, I'd like to kind of underline what he just said. We are facing, and I think today's headline talks about mental health crisis that is before us, and in a community such as this one that we're in right now that has a booming housing market compared to some of the rest of the country right now, and some very nice housing every day I cross the bridge and look at the homeless who are there all the time. And if we can't get services to those people if we don't know where they are, if they're moving around. And the key piece is housing. And in the mental health area, the key piece is housing so that you can stabilize people because they can be very productive. So this is one of our cornerstone programs in that arena. I think it is worthy of a lot of our attention.
Chair Barnhart and Representative Berger, thanks for that comment, because one of the things we have seen is that when you move people out of an institutional setting and into the community-based care, we just have a lot better results. They're a lot more stable. They become a lot more independent. And their quality of life, quite frankly, is quite a bit greater than that compared to the institution. But in order to move people into community-based care, again, we need the affordable units that we can move them to.
Thank you. And thank you for the comment. I completely agree with that comment. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Chair.
I think you have another panel for us.
Yes. I'd like to introduce Janet Bird from the Neighborhood Partnership Fund and Bill Van Vliet from the Network of Oregon Affordable Housing. They have a companion bill that they would like to discuss with you for the short term, what we were referring to earlier as the short term fix.
Okay.
Chair Barnhart and members of the committee, my name is Janet Bird, and I'm the Executive Director of the Neighborhood Partnership Fund. I also am here today on behalf of the Housing Alliance, which is an advocacy coalition representing members statewide who are concerned about the shortage of affordable homes for hardworking, low-income Oregonians, the disabled members of our communities, and our vulnerable neighbors. As has already been mentioned, with the support of Senator Betsy Johnson, the Housing Alliance will have a proposal before you in February which will address some of the short-term financing needs of these properties. We're going to be asking for an allocation of $2.75 million of general fund to meet critical housing needs, and of that, $2 million will go into a housing acquisition fund. The state's investment of $2 million will be matched and leveraged by private foundations, local jurisdictions, and private lenders to provide an estimated $150 million over 6 years in interim financing. This provides a critical tool to address the issue that you've heard about today, the preservation of subsidized housing located in all corners of the state, housing these particularly vulnerable members of our communities. And Bill Van Vliet is going to speak in a moment about the structure of the fund. The Housing Alliance sees our February request and the Housing Council's request to expand the capacity of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit as two essential components of a strategy to address this compelling issue. The Housing Acquisition Fund will provide a ready pool of money to support community-based and nonprofit buyers. We know from experience that many of the owners of these properties are aging, and many are just sort of ready to move on to other pursuits. Some might be a little tired of dealing with HUD rules and regulations. And we know that many of them, given the choice, would prefer to sell to a purchaser who will maintain the current tenants. But they may not be willing to wait the extra time that it would take for a non-profit purchaser to arrange permanent financing, often having to go through the consolidated funding cycle that Mr. Krager referred to. Time-consuming effort, and so an owner who had two competing offers to purchase the property might feel compelled to take the offer from whoever had the ready cash available. So we're really trying to provide that nimble, flexible pool of money so that these community-based purchasers can act quickly. Supporting these transfers to new owners who are willing to make that long-term commitment to keeping these properties affordable is obviously in the best interest of the communities. It keeps the federal subsidies in place, keeps residents in place, prevents displacement, and prevents us having to try to figure out ways to replace that housing. And you've heard a little bit about the cost it would entail to replace this housing. Once an interim purchase has been made, however, that, again, isn't the whole story, the new owners still would have to be coming into the state for permanent financing. State funds, in addition to the money committed, the $8 million committed in 2007 to provide the equity gap financing for these properties, and additional commitments of the OEHTC will be necessary. In closing, I want to just say that we very much appreciate your considering this issue today, and your willingness to consider increasing the availability of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit, and also your concern and compassion for the residents of the properties and concern about the impact on communities. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Bill Van Vliet, and I am the executive director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, and we're a nonprofit consortium of banks that provides financing, both short-term and long-term, for affordable housing projects all over the state. We were formed in 1990 by the Oregon Bankers Association. We have about 22 banks that finance our programs and fund us. One of our major banks is Wells Fargo, who you heard from earlier today. So they're involved in this affordable housing business on a lot of different fronts. Although I'm going to talk just briefly about the short-term component, I do want to mention that we're probably one of the larger users of the Oregon Affordable Housing Tax Credit through our programs. And almost all of our projects rely on that resource to achieve affordability. And I just want to say briefly, it's really one of the most powerful tools that we have at our disposal to get the affordability of these projects down to meet the needs of our lowest income households around the state. So it's really valuable. We see it every day in the work that we do. So as mentioned, there's really two major components that we're working on to deal with the preservation projects, the expire and use projects from HUD and rural development. And the long-term solution includes the OHTC. The fund that we're talking about will provide the acquisition financing for the projects. These are set to expire on a varying time frame. They will just simply go. A lot of these will be listed for sale through brokers, and so the goal is to have a resource available to secure these and acquire them as quickly as possible by buyers who will commit to retain long-term affordability. Once we sort of have them safe and secured, then that'll give us the time we need over a short period, over sort of 1 to 4 years. To get the permanent financing put into place for these projects. But without this ability and the short-term resources, our buyers just simply won't be able to compete with investors who can respond very quickly to a seller. And so there's a very compelling need to have the flexible resources available to us. But as mentioned, this is only the first step, and again, the OHTC is a critical tool that we need for the long-term financing packages that will ultimately be assembled over a couple-year period of time. As Janet mentioned, our goal is to assemble a large fund that relies with some seed money from the state that will leverage private foundation and other jurisdictions' investments into the fund. We'll take those as equity-type investments and then leverage a considerable amount of private bank money into this fund. So we're hoping to have about $15 million in public and private foundation money that will leverage $35 million in bank money. Then we'll use that over a six-year period of time. We'll revolve that three times to get $150 million worth of investments and loans made on these projects. So you can see a small state investment will get us a big pot of resources to go out and secure these properties, which is the very first step to preserving the affordable housing. This is a statewide issue. It affects every corner of the state, and a lot of the smaller communities that we have, sometimes these preservation projects that we have come to refer to them as are the only affordable housing projects in these communities, which makes them extremely valuable to preserve. And without a conscientious effort and a program, we stand a much greater risk of losing them and that valuable housing. So we're hoping to have the support of the state on both the OHTC for the permanent piece, but then also on the shorter fund investment so we can make sure we secure the projects. So thank you. We appreciate your interest in this issue and in affordable housing, and we hope to have an opportunity to talk to you more as the session progresses.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Berger?
No question of them.
Mm-hmm.
sort of a process question, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
I don't see a draft in front of me concerning this.
Okay. Let me make a comment on that issue.
Okay.
There are essentially two committees involved in this work. The tax credit issue, which I think you're referring to as the OHTC, I finally did figure out what that acronym meant. I don't do acronyms, so that's a challenge for me. But that issue will, if it's dealt with, come through this committee. And if we deal with it, it would, we think, fit into the relating clause of the Betsy bill that we've already described and that we're going to act on next week. I don't think it's going to be ready, except as an amendment during the session, for us to act on before that. I don't see that happening.
That's sort of the heart of my question. And then Senator Johnson also has a bill that...
Right. And, of course, I'm not referring to Senate bills. It may be that there is a Senate bill that we can use instead. And then the other piece, there was a reference to the general fund, the piece we're talking about right now. We all know very well that goes through the Ways and Means Committee.
Absolutely.
And so we won't be dealing with that directly, but I think it is valuable for us to hear this entire conversation, because these are two pieces of one package, and I believe that it's really important for us to coordinate with the Ways and Means Committee whatever we decide to do.
Yes, I agree. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just
wanted that clarification of them.
Thank you, Representative Berger. I had a question on this issue. The way you described the fund, it sounds as though there's some place or another where there's where money actually gets spent and doesn't come back. You said that the expectation is that this $2 million will be augmented with other funds, a much larger amount, and then it will turn over about three times. What happens? Are we spending some portion of it in the process, or does the money come back, or what happens to it?
Well, no, the money will continue and the fund will continue. We're just talking about a 6-month window when the majority of these projects are coming through for expiration.
6-year window.
6-year window, sorry. But there will be continuing projects mm-hmm. that will mature in out years.
Let me put it a different way. Is this truly a revolving fund in the sense that eventually all the money comes back in and you have it available for other projects? Or is this a fund in which eventually it gets spent?
So some of the money, the foundation money that's contemplated to come in, will come in as program-related investments, which is essentially a very low-interest loan. And I think those will come in at about a 7-year term is what we're anticipating. So some of the initial seed capital that's going in acting like equity will disappear after 7 years and, you know, could potentially be replaced or renewed. It's at this point it's not certain.
Right.
And what about the general fund money that you were describing?
That will stay in the fund and continue to leverage bank resources and continue to address future expiring use projects that will continue to come due just after this big surge that we're really focused on designing this bigger system to solve.
So we're spending this, if the Ways and Means Committee and the legislature decides to do this, we're not really spending this money. We're simply, it's not available for other general fund uses, but it will stay in a revolving account and be available as it's repaid for purposes connected with the revolving account later.
Right.
Is that a reasonable summary?
That's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
And Chair Barnhart, if I might, this is sort of the front end of an issue that is going to continue for many years into the future. This is the first. We're seeing now three universes of properties that are sort of coming to the end of their affordability periods. There are also many federal tax credit properties that have been built by nonprofit owners and private owners across the state that are going to be coming to the end of their affordability period. So this is going to be a continuing issue over the years to come, and so there will be the need for the fund to continue.
And then if I could ask just one final thing. It sounds as though part of what you're describing is sort of a contest between your organization and your attempt to maintain housing in an affordable housing setting or condition, I guess, and people operating in private business who may have completely different interests in mind and the need to be able to compete.
Yes, I think that's absolutely true.
And I think the other thing I would add, Chair Barnhart, I had the opportunity in the early 90s to work on the first wave of these properties, which were HUD-subsidized mortgage, or HUD properties that had HUD-subsidized mortgages, had also the Section 8. And many of those owners who were private owners really did, they were motivated by the populations that they were serving.
Sure.
But when they're faced with having to wait 2 years to sell to a nonprofit and being able to sell immediately to someone who wants to convert to condos or tear the property down to build something entirely different, that's a difficult position to put those owners in. There's only so far that that their public motivation will carry them.
Thank you. That's a better description than the one I gave. Appreciate it. Other things? Okay. It looks to me as though we've gotten through this piece of the agenda. Are there any other questions that anyone has? Is there anything for the committee? There is one other item, and then we can adjourn, and that is the next meeting. It has been proposed that we meet Thursday afternoon next week. I would anticipate that being a short meeting, and those members who couldn't actually be here could join by telephone, probably at 1:30 in the afternoon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Gelser.
Representative Olson and I are on the Human Services and Women's Wellness Committee, which is meeting at that time.
Yeah, meeting exactly at that time. Okay.
We'll skip it. Come down here for the...
Yeah, I think we're probably talking about a 10 or 15-minute meeting, aren't we? Yeah, okay.
Mr. Chair, we would email everybody the LC, so you'd have a chance to look at it and see it. What we could do is get representatives out of their meeting for 5 minutes or so and have them come down.
This is the Betsy draft. There are three of us who are here anyway for the tax revenue restructure commission. Two for this committee. I think we're going to save some per diem that day.
I'm available that day.
And you're available that day as well. Good. It looks like we'll be able to have a quorum. So anticipate that you'll get a notice of a meeting then at 1:30 on Thursday. 1:30 Thursday next week for a very, very, hopefully very, very short meeting to consider the draft on the Betsy amendments. Okay? Anything else?
On the Betsy LC.
The Betsy Legislative Council draft. Yes.
And pointed out, Mr. Chair, this if the committee is wanting to develop a response to the proposal today, that would be the vehicle in which we would anticipate.
That would be the vehicle. I think at this point what we need to do is see if we can get a bill going. And
yes.
And if we can, then this could be added to it.
Yes.
If we decide that that's where we want to go. Anything else today? If not, have a safe trip home, and the interim House Committee on Revenue is adjourned.